With Robinhood Gold, you don't need a silver spoon to eat up the financial favors of the 1%. Robinhood Gold allows a resourceful individual to earn the very liberal rate of 4.5% APY on uninvested cash, receive unlimited 1% deposit bonuses, and be rewarded with a handsome 3% retirement boost on an IRA account. Get the privileges of the high net worth for any net worth for just $5 a month. Sign up at Robinhood.com/gold. Terms apply. For product-specific disclosures, visit Robinhood.com/gold. Investing involves risk. Rate may change. Gold membership is offered by Robinhood Gold LLC.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. Starting your day the right way with the Andy Griffin Show. This is News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Hey, good morning. 908 on KDXU. It is November the 4th. I did want to mention my mom's birthday was yesterday. My mom passed away a few years ago, but just happy birthday up there in heaven. One of the listeners, Scotty, texted me and said, hey, my mom's birthday was yesterday as well, and she's passed away. And yeah, so happy birthday up there in heaven. But, good morning, everybody. I'm Andy. Dr. Blodgett is with me today. You're like, what, on a Monday? No, Dr. Blodgett's never here on a Monday. But with the election tomorrow and then the election results on Wednesday, I thought it'd be better to move the doctor up a couple of days. Thanks for coming. I appreciate you being here.
It's good to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
We just played a commercial for a drug, and that before we get into some of the stuff I wanted to talk about, I thought, you know, I think there's one other country in the entire world that lets drug companies, medicine companies, run commercials. And I wonder what our public health official thinks about that.
Yeah.
It's crazy that, and I know they came up with a rule, you have to list the side effects or in the commercial and stuff like that, but still, you just think, yeah, is it really all about money, the healthcare system?
Yeah. I mean, it's remarkable how much you can change prescribing practices, because then somebody goes into their doctor and says, I really think I should have this drug that you saw. And something else would be just fine. Or maybe they're not even, maybe they don't even have that situation, and you have to work through that as a physician. It definitely slants things in ways you don't necessarily want.
They don't even try to hide it anymore. Ask your doctor about this, right. You know, when they end their commercials. Like, what the heck, you know? And I went in last week to see my doctor and asked him. I did that. I asked him about a certain drug, and he goes, you know, I get a lot of questions about that drug. And then he was able to kind of lay out how he feels about it and everything. And I've been going to the same doctor for a long time, so I feel like he was very candid with me, but the truth of the matter is, these companies come in, they hey, here's a bunch of free samples you can give out. And, I don't know, do they offer them trips sometimes to go, let's go to the Caribbean or what? I don't know.
But yeah, I don't think it gets quite that bad, but it's just, you want to serve the people you treat as a doctor, and when they're demanding something, it creates a whole different dynamic than here's what I think you have and here's the medication that I think would be best for what you have going on.
So. Anyway, Dr. Blodgett is here. By the way, Mello is with us today too, not here on a Monday usually either. Hi, Mello.
Good morning.
You doing okay over there?
I'm so splendid.
Doctor can't see you. He's got his back to you, but I can barely see you because of the glare on the window.
I know.
It's kind of hard to see.
I'm hiding, but I'm here.
You can see better this way, right? You don't have a glare coming this way.
There's a bit
direction.
Of a glare, but it's all good.
All right. Well, thanks for being here. We're going to talk, and I actually had Mello in mind a little bit as I was researching this, about some of the medical myths that we believed our whole lives. Mello is a mother to 7 children.
Wow.
And she has taught them many of these medical pieces of advice, right? I mean, don't sit too close to the TV. You'll hurt your eyes. Don't go in the water after eating for a certain amount of time. But we have the smart guy here. We have the expert. We have the medical. We have the doctor in town. And one thing I found out about Dr. Blodgett, he's very well read and very very well educated. And he'll give us the definitive answer on some of these.
I'm excited to hear these.
All right. Good. Well, let's start at the top. Number one. How many times have we heard this? If you crack your knuckles, I just did it, it's going to cause arthritis. Doctor, does cracking your knuckles cause arthritis?
So I have to issue a little disclaimer.
Okay, I know he likes to do this.
I'm not the expert on it.
You are an expert. He's being humble.
No, I'm not.
He's a smart guy.
So generally, when you pop your knuckles, you're creating an increase of pressure in the knuckle, and then you release that pressure.
Mm-hmm.
It has been tied to a little more looseness of your joints.
Okay.
But as far as causing arthritis, an actual wear on tear on the bone that causes, you know, age-related arthritis and stuff, it seems less likely that that's a problem.
Okay, so but does it make big fat knuckles? Because my ex-husband used to say, don't do that, you're going to have big old fat knuckles when you're old. I'm like, well, okay.
Yeah, it probably isn't related to it as much as you'd think.
Okay.
But sometimes we have a hard time understanding, you know, particularly rheumatoid arthritis, why that starts. And so that's where a lot of the fat knuckle stuff comes from a lot of the pain in your knuckles and stuff like that. And so osteoarthritis, just wear and tear on the joints, we get from just living and working and stuff like that.
It's so, like people have to have knee replacement and stuff, right?
Right, exactly.
Wear and tear on everything.
So you can get those in your hands and... but the actual connection to popping your knuckles is not very well established. So,
So it's not the years; it's the miles.
Yeah, it's the wear and tear.
Yeah, if you can find a 2020 with only 40,000 miles, do it. Right?
Yeah, buy it.
I mean, a 2004 that's 20 years old. That's what I meant.
I know what you mean.
All right, myth number two, or is it? Coffee will dehydrate you. I guess there is a mild diuretic in coffee, right?
Yeah. Caffeine is also a diuretic.
Okay.
So you double whammy it with coffee. but and it's also, it leaches calcium from your bones.
Really? It leaches, so, makes it go away.
So most of the time the recommendation for that is to have cream in your coffee, you know, make it a little sweeter that way. But there are those concerns with coffee.
Okay. Okay, so not necessarily a myth?
Interestingly enough, we're so antioxidant deprived in our society because we don't eat our fruits and vegetables.
Right,
that caffeine and coffee end up being one of the most prevalent antioxidants in our diet. So there's an offset to some of those downsides, but there's other reasons why coffee's not good too.
Wait. So that means soda could be effectively the same thing if there's a lot of caffeine in it?
No. It's not caffeine.
Oh.
It's antioxidants. So the coffee bean itself has antioxidant properties as well as cocoa.
I was going to say, let's endorse chocolate while we're here, okay?
Yes.
Especially dark chocolate.
It's dark chocolate that they point to, but... So I find that a little ironic because, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs to virtually everything, but I think it's more of an indictment of the American diet than it is about the virtues of coffee. So,
what do you say? Well, let me decode that. We don't eat very good here in America with all our processed foods and junk foods and soda pops and things like that. So.
Yeah.
Thanks for defining that, because I'd missed that. It went over my head.
By the way, Mel, how's the diet coming over there?
No soda, water. Still? This is like week three.
Hey,
way to go.
That's wonderful to hear. Yeah. You know,
I'm impressed. Dr. Blodgett tries not to talk too much about soda when he's on my show because he knows I have a mild addiction that I'm working on. But anyway, all right, myth number three. For the three of us, we're teetotalers. We don't drink alcohol, but there is a myth out there that if you get drunk and have a hangover the next morning, they call it hair of the dog, if you drink alcohol the next morning, it'll make your hangover go away. That is, according to what I was reading, doctor, that is completely not true. It might make you feel better for a minute, but it's not going to make the hangover go away. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, and you're just prolonging the agony, right?
So
That I wouldn't go with that one.
Procrastination there, huh?
I think an alcoholic wrote that answer.
Yeah.
Perhaps so.
Well, and there really isn't anything that helps with that, really. I mean, I think they think coffee does or some other concoctions that they can get. But the reality is you're trying to clear all of that waste product from the alcohol out of your system and just take some time. So.
I saw a video earlier today. I didn't watch it because I was on the air, but I saw it going and it was interested in that. It said, imagine someone coming to Earth or coming to society for the first time and you're trying to explain alcohol to them.
Yeah.
Basically, so you say, okay, so here you go. All you do is drink this. And they're like, what is it? Well, it's kind of poison, but it'll make you feel good later if you drink enough of the poison. But if you drink too much, you will die. But, you know, and I was like, yeah, why do we even drink alcohol? I don't know. I've never been drunk, so I don't know.
You know, alcohol is... we talk about what people die from, heart disease, things like that. But then we also, and probably I'll talk a lot about the underlying things that kill people. And alcohol is third on the list, independent of anything else. So it's,
and so that means from what alcohol does to you, from cancer to DUI to all those things that alcohol does.
And that's independent of accidents, right, which is a leading killer associated with alcohol. So... alcoholic cirrhosis, it is an independent risk factor for cancer, perhaps second only to smoking. And it's the World Health Organization, which is a little less susceptible to advertising, declared it a major public health issue, perhaps one of their biggest concerns worldwide when you think about the amount of alcohol consumed worldwide. So just something to put on your radar screen.
Wait, I have a question. I'm sorry, can I ask a
question? Yeah, no, do it.
What kind of cancer does alcoholism cause?
Throat, liver.
Liver, yeah.
Oh,
colon.
Okay. That makes sense.
Even links to breast cancer and prostate cancer, stuff like that.
Yeah, alcohol is... there was a myth. This isn't on my list, but there was a myth that, well, if you drink... one glass of wine a day or one beer a day, it's actually better for you than if you didn't. But that's kind of been debunked too, hasn't it?
Yeah, that was... So part of the problem is the way you ask the question when you do the research.
The leading question. We learned this in statistics class in college.
Yeah, and so they... There's always conflicting data. There's a study that will come out and say, no, the alcohol itself is beneficial, but it most likely the preponderance of the evidence is it's that antioxidant effect from grapes and
grapes,
wine.
Yeah.
Oh.
And resveratrol, if you've heard of that. So you can get the same effect by, again, healthy diet, including
or eating some grapes.
And then you avoid the alcohol, which is the poison ring.
So. Yeah. All right, let's talk about CPR for a minute. Now, in the course of my lifetime, CPR has gone from, you know, it was actually called mouth-to-mouth resuscitation before it was even called CPR. And then for a while there, not that long ago, they said you no longer need to do mouth-to-mouth as long as you're doing the chest compressions. And then I read a thing the other day that if someone's heart is actually stopped and you're keeping it going with CPR, the chance of that person even surviving is like less than 10%. Can you clear up everything about CPR for us?
Well, maybe not everything.
Okay. Well, as much as you can.
Okay, just kidding. The numbers are grim. If something happens to make your heart stop and you're not, even if you're in the hospital and they call the code and everybody rushes in and they're pumping on you.
Yeah,
you
adrenaline know, needles and all that.
And
yeah.
doing the electro, you know, the shocks and everything, it's still really low numbers that you can bring back. That's not the case if somebody drowns or, you know, you're a young person or something. But if you're, it's really hard to get this heart to stop beating. And if you are in that situation, it's really hard to get it going again, if that makes sense. So, and I actually think this is an important discussion because if you're there and you're doing CPR and the person still dies, you feel like, oh, I did something wrong.
There's like guilt. That. Yeah.
And you see the AED stations all over the place, you know, and you can run out and shock somebody. But in reality, the numbers are just not good. Probably 10% is high. Actually, it's probably more like 5% that you can do something with. They have changed the recommendations over time. Sometimes they put the breath back in there. Sometimes they leave it off. Kind of depends on the trainer. But most of the time you'll see just compressions without the breaths in there. And you're just trying to keep something flowing enough before somebody can get there with an oxygen machine or something. But I know there was this huge effort to get people to take CPR. There are definitely benefits from knowing that, and there's wonderful stories where people are saved. But just be aware that a lot of times that's
a pretty good chance
it's not going to help. If they're choking, pulling something out certainly does good. Heimlich maneuver. I mean, it's good to know all of those skills, but I do think there's some value in helping people understand that Once that heart stops, it's really difficult to get it going again.
I could see definitely guilt involved if you... I was right there, right after they had their heart attack or whatever it was, and I did the compressions, and what did I do wrong? You know, I must have screwed up. I didn't do it right. I didn't...
I've known people, they were there, they did all the pumping, they actually followed him in the ambulance to the hospital to see how they did, you know, and then they died, and or they were dead by the time they made it there, and they just felt bad that they didn't do it right, but that's just not the case.
So. Okay, what about the mouth-to-mouth part? You mentioned it briefly, but should we be doing mouth-to-mouth and breathing air into their lungs? Will that help?
Currently, that's not part of the recommendations. No. I don't know if that'll come back or not, but generally what they say is you're not moving the blood fast enough to have the exchange of air from that going into their lungs.
I actually read something that said if you don't break a rib when you're doing CPR, you're not doing it right, or something like that. I don't know if that holds any water.
I mean, I guess that's... It has to be fairly deep compression. You have to be actually compressing.
You have to really push hard on it. Okay. Yeah,
but I don't know if you have to plan on breaking ribs.
Ouch. Okay. Well, so bottom line on CPR is, you know, it's like the medical industry in general. Saving a life, you know, someone may have a traumatic brain injury, but if they can save a life, one in 20, one in 100, whatever, it's worth it still, right? That's why CPR is still alive. That's why we still go ahead and do it, because the odds are not good. 95% chance they're not going to live, you know, if their heart is stopped already. But there is that 1 in 20, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and there are those situations where it works much better than in others. So just knowing it's a good thing.
Now, what about, I always wondered about drowning victims. And I have had friends who have had their little kids drown in a pool or whatever, and they were able to bring them back. Are there some guidelines for that? Should we know how long are they in the pool? Things like that.
Well, the rule of thumb is, if you're without oxygen for more than 5 minutes, you're starting into damaging tissues and brain damage and stuff like that. So, but that's a big window if you're right there, right? If you come out and you find them and they're floating in the pool and you don't know how long it's been, that's the scenario that's a nightmare for every parent, you know, and.
So do you turn them sideways, try to get them to spit the water out, but then
you're doing the CPR, you're turning their head, you're trying to get the water out, all of that stuff. But generally they'll respond pretty quickly if they're okay.
If it's going to happen, it's going to happen pretty quick. If it's not happening, then all right. All right. There was that sad story. I don't remember last year. I think it was in one of the five counties, wasn't it? In one of your five counties, the little kid that tried to cross the creek in his little toy tractor and got swept downstream and drowned. And they thought, oh, maybe we can bring him back. But, you know, it was, you know, at that point it was too late.
It's heartrending. It is. Every year we have two or three kids that'll make it too close to a stream or river somewhere, and you know, the parents are looking around. They're like, what happened to?
Yeah, what happened? Only takes a few seconds.
And I can't imagine the terror. I really can't.
The runoff, especially in northern Utah, the runoff when the snow melt happens. I remember tame little Provo River becoming just this raging torrent in runoff season, and people got too close. You know, grown ups even got too close and got swept away. And it's. You can't win against Mother Nature in those types of cases.
Yeah. The other scenario where I think CPR does better than in others is if somebody's been shocked, electrocuted, you know, there's a down power line or something like that.
Yeah.
If their heart's, you know, you're having a heart attack and it's full of plaque and, you know, they're... You've got to get them to the hospital and try and free that up. But once it stops all the way, it's really hard to get that going again.
All right, we're talking medical myths with Dr. Blodgett today. Okay, I got a sore throat. Somebody told me, my mom used to tell me, gargle with salt water. That'll fix it. Does it fix it? It soothes it immediately, right? Initially, that's a good thing.
There might be some value to that, right? And there's... salt is actually a natural preservative. It's kind of got some antibacterial qualities to it, so I don't think it's a terrible idea. I don't know that it will, if the infection's firmly entrenched, it's not going to do much. But yeah. I don't see a lot of harm in that.
Mello, have you ever gargled with salt water?
I was tempted to this morning. I have a canker sore today.
Oh, salt and canker, they don't go together, do they?
I looked it up online, and it said to rinse your mouth out with salt water. But I was like, that sounds kind of gross. So the next option was rinse your mouth out with hydrogen peroxide, but don't swallow. So I opted
like a bad idea
for a Q-tip with hydrogen peroxide, and it did kind of soothe it.
Oh, okay.
And then I just spit out.
Isn't the stuff you bleach your hair with?
Yeah, I don't know.
But it's definitely an antiseptic, so it will kill off bad bugs for sure.
It did help. It feels much better.
Okay.
So
there you go.
People use hydrogen peroxide for a lot of things, you know, fresh breath and whitening your teeth.
I've heard using it instead of toothpaste because the toothpaste has lots of chemicals.
Or put it in your toothpaste or, you know, whatever. So there's definite properties of hydrogen peroxide that are helpful.
Let's do one more before the break. This one I heard it a million times, right? You're sitting too close to the TV. You're going to ruin your eyes. Does sitting too close to the TV actually ruin your eyes?
Or a computer screen? Mm-hmm.
Or virtual reality glasses?
Right on your face.
So this is one of those... it depends kind of things. It creates a lot of eye strain is what it does, and the eye strain over time can cause trouble. There's also the thing we've talked about where screens, TVs, computers, iPhones, they're blue light.
Right,
they'll destroy your capacity to sleep, right, and make it harder to
sleep. I was going to say, that thing my wife has told me, she's like, don't look at your phone for a little while before you go to bed because that blue light will make it so you can't sleep.
Yeah, and so electronic devices, blue light, is the exact spectrum of daylight that triggers your body to not release melatonin so you can be awake and active through the day. Hmm. When you get into the nighttime, when you're supposed to have dark, and so you start producing melatonin, that confuses your production system, and so you don't get that melatonin surge to help you go to sleep. So I would say there's two problems with too much TV. One is that eye strain problem that can wreak havoc with your eyes, but that's part of the sleep continuum that we've been talking about that's a good way to make it so you don't sleep very well.
The human body is this amazing thing. So the kind of light that the sun gives us, our body detects that as saying, hey, I need to be awake because the sun is out.
Right.
I didn't even think about that, but that's amazing to me. And then, and now these devices, one of which I'm holding right here, and another one right here, they're sending that same light to my brain, and my brain is saying, you need to be awake.
Yeah, exactly.
That's incredible.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, couldn't the manufacturers of those devices use a different type of light so it doesn't interfere with sleep? Or is that the only light we can see?
And they're trying, right? You have night mode on, like, your iPhone kind of thing. And stuff like that. It still is... not as good as not doing it.
Right.
It's better than having big, bright blue light. But then it, you know, often doesn't work as well for what you're trying to accomplish and things like that.
Yeah,
so,
we're kind of spoiled. We want things a certain way as consumers.
Yeah. Unfortunately, LED lights, which we tend to have a lot of,
the
daylight lights, particularly that spectrum of the light is in that continuum, and so that will be a problem. If you use the warm lights, you know, the little bit yellower light, that's better, but it still has an effect on your melatonin. And so really the best advice is to dim all the lights as you start to get towards bedtime and stay off your devices for an hour or two before you try to go to bed. And what they'll do is they can actually, you know, they'll track your melatonin levels, and they'll show that they start to go up, but then it'll
cut them off at the pass.
Once you get that blue light going, it'll start to come back up, but it takes about 2 hours to recover from that.
Oh, wow.
And alarmingly, Kids, they crater, but they don't come back up.
Ew.
So they lose that ability to sleep. Well. And so you get kids that don't sleep, and then you wonder if they have ADHD or whatever, and it compounds other issues that they're facing in their life. And so a word of warning to parents, you know, keep the devices down right before bedtime.
So, what do you think it is that makes it so theirs doesn't go back up compared to an adult?
I don't know if it's maturity of the ability to produce it, or they just have higher amounts to begin with. Kids sleep pretty well usually, but and then that gets pulled down. I have to confess, you're one layer of detail away from what I've studied, but we have a real problem with kids not sleeping well in our society. When you ask high school seniors what percentage of them get their 8 hours of sleep tonight, the number's like 22% or something like that. But sleep's when you consolidate all your memory, all your ability to kind of process the world. REM sleep is when all of that stuff happens, and you don't get REM sleep until the latter part of the sleep cycle. And so you end up really shorting yourself of the ability to be smart and to also fend off mental health issues, depression, anxiety, all of that stuff is much worse if you're not sleeping.
And I have a daughter that's 14, and I took her screen away too late. Like, I do now have it in another room before she goes to bed, but she does have issues with sleep, and she does have to take trazodone, and she does have depression and anxiety issues because of probably that.
Well, there you go. So
it's amazing how it's all interconnected. You know, we talk a lot about, and this is one of the charities that I really get behind, is suicide prevention. But if you think about, if a teenager's not getting enough sleep because of the blue light or whatever reason, getting enough sleep is what helps you process all the emotions and feeling, everything that you experienced during the day. The next day you didn't process all that because you only got 4 hours of sleep.
Yeah.
Then anxiety, depression, and suicidal thoughts can creep in there because you're just not getting enough sleep.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's all connected.
Let me one up you one more and say there's good research going on now where they say, you know, one of the problems with PTSD, people that suffer long-term chronic PTSD, is the PTSD keeps them from sleeping long enough to get into REM sleep, and the REM sleep is what would help them process that and make it better. And so they're trying to figure out, how do you stimulate enough sleep to get them because it's this vicious circle, right? The event recurs, it keeps you from getting into REM sleep, which makes it harder to process, and so you end up in this in-between land where you can't really get to where you need to be because you're not getting the sleep that you need. And so that's the research going on. It might be revolutionary to help people that, you know, struggle with a very difficult issue, independent of medications and all that stuff, just helping them get back into the proper sleep cycles.
So. And one thing, and I got to get a break in here, but I wanted to ask you this before we go to break. You talked about the fact that getting sleep aided through a sleeping pill or other means is not as effective as getting unaided sleep. Yeah. Why is that?
Well, it's not sleep.
It's not really sleep.
It's sedation. Mm. Sedation is different than sleep, right?
Oh, no.
And so you look at the sleep patterns where you get into deeper stages of sleep and then you get into REM and stuff like that. Alcohol, for example, blocks REM sleep, and you never actually get into deep sleep. Marijuana, same, blocks your, and so it's so effective at blocking REM sleep that you increase your chances of schizophrenia, you know, many times over by being a regular smoker of marijuana. And caffeine and nicotine, they're kind of on the other end of the spectrum. They stimulate you so much that you can't get into sleep either. So if you put sleeping pills on the same spectrum there, the sleeping pills, they're in the sedating camp of alcohol. And so it's just not true sleep. It's sedation, not sleep. And in fact, it actually blocks good, healthy sleep. And so, and then you get into this really vicious cycle where you don't think you're sleeping and you can't sleep without the sleeping pill. Mm-hmm. But in reality, you're not really sleeping. And so you're tired. And so you take more sleeping pills and you just end up on this really bad path down. And so.
Wow. Man.
That's terrifying. Yeah, gosh.
It's kind of scary.
What a dose of sunshine today.
All right. We'll talk some more.
We aim to please.
We'll talk some more myths when we come back. I do need to get to talk about Heartlight Funeral Services real quick. And we're talking about not getting enough sleep and dying. Well, anyway, Heartlight Funeral Services, they have a different take on the end-of-life services. Now, for those of you who have lost a loved one, and we've all, I think, lost someone close to us, there's a couple of ways you can look at it. I hate to bring Cookie Monster up, but everybody says, asked Cookie Monster once, they said, hey, are you sad that the cookies are all gone? And the Cookie Monster, with a really wise answer, said, no, me not sad cookies are gone, me happy that cookies were here in the first place. That's how Heartlight Funeral Services feels about life and losing our loved ones. Yes, you can be sad, and certainly you should be sad. We're going to miss them. But they want to celebrate the life that was, though. They want to celebrate the person that had this great influence upon your life. And that's kind of what Heartlight Funeral Services is all about. Now, they have a new store. They've been in Cedar for many years. Now they have a new store here in Washington County, right there at 504 West Buena Vista Boulevard, across from what used to be the Too Lazy Two Ranch restaurant. It's a church now, but they don't have a chapel. So, you know, I mean, they said most people, if they do have services, they either have a gravesite or they have a chapel at their church that they use. So they don't have a chapel. But what they do have, they have this incredibly bright and cheerful and upbeat location. They have a 24-foot wall where they can play a celebration of your loved one's life. They have big screen TVs, they have recliners, and they have really prices that beat anybody else around. It's Heartlight Funeral Services. Check them out online, heartlightfs.com. Or like I said, you can stop by their place at 504 West Buena Vista Boulevard. Heartlight Funeral Services is a proud sponsor of the Andy Griffin Show, and they are AG approved.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
Welcome back, 942 on KDXU. We're talking with medical professional, our area, five-county area medical officer, I guess, Dr. David Blodgett, who makes a monthly appearance on the show. Yeah, he's a couple of days early this month. That's my fault. And we just had a lot of election coverage we wanted to take care of the next couple of days. So Dr. Blodgett graciously agreed to come in early. I appreciate it.
It's good. I'm glad to. Maybe we'll throw people off a little bit. The people that don't want to listen to me.
I'm all for throwing people off. That's kind of fun. You know what? I had these myths right in front of me, and then I don't know what. Somehow my screen updated to something I didn't want. I wanted to talk about vaccines a little bit. Vaccines took a big hit with COVID. A lot of people feel like they were betrayed. A lot of people feel like they called this COVID shot a vaccine when it didn't prevent the disease. And then a weird thing happened. It went from, okay, COVID vaccine, not sure about, that means I'm not sure about all the vaccines. Yeah. And that has really, really done a lot of harm.
Yeah.
It's frustrating, right, to a medical professional?
Yeah, well, among the most effective things we've ever done as a system is,
in history,
is figure out how to use vaccines to prevent some pretty darn serious diseases over history, right? So the only disease that's ever been eradicated from the face of the planet, smallpox, used to kill one-third of the people that got it. And
you think about
it. It's hard to imagine the horrificness of a disease that kills a third of the people that get it.
And 33% mortality.
And another third were so badly scarred that it would, you know, people would just hide out from the world and, you know, it really caused a lot of social disruption.
But I know people, Dr. Blodgett, right now who say, well, vaccines made my kid autistic, or vaccines made my kid sick, or whatever. I can think of one in particular. He swears by it. He's like, you'll never convince me otherwise. Yeah. Why can I tell someone like that?
Well, it might be the most studied issue in the history of medicine.
I think so, yeah.
And, you know, studies have been done repeatedly to try and establish that link or disprove that link. And they've all disproven the link. The problem is once something takes on a life of its own, then it just never comes back, right?
Yeah.
And so, so the... And I would argue that the science of trying to figure out what's going on with autism and helping treat it has been put back 20 years by that that debate that's gone. And so we would be much further ahead if we would have put that money into trying to figure out what's really going on with autism. But
bottom line, let me summarize real quick. Vaccines do not cause autism, right. Period. They just don't.
They don't. And here's the problem you have with the vaccine that is has been prior to the issue from day one is you can identify in your mind when a vaccination happened, right? And
right.
So then naturally your brain lumps everything together with that vaccine at
sure.
that point. And so
yeah,
a lot of times we hear people saying things, well, they got vaccinated, so this happened. But if you really go back and look at the records, they were there before the vaccination happened.
Yeah.
And unfortunately with autism, it's something that doesn't really become very obvious until the child's
old enough you can tell.
Right?
Yeah,
and
sure.
So they say, oh, they're vaccinated. It had to be that. But the reality is, kids that are vaccinated actually are less likely to have autism.
Wow.
But it's at least a break even proposition. And so, there is, ironically enough, probably emerging. I mean, all of this is, you know, we have to use hedging language in all of the science that we do. But mothers that have the flu while they're pregnant are much more likely to have autistic kids.
Wow. Just the flu.
Yeah. Influenza.
Wow.
So, I don't know that we're ever going to get to a point where we have a universal agreement on anything in our society. And unfortunately,
and
this is divided along pretty, you know, pretty established lines of warfare. And I just, it's just tragic because, you know, the right before we got a vaccination for measles, for example, 5,000 kids a year would die from measles. Right. And measles has these really strange complications that are just horrifying. Right. So the baby will get measles. They're 1 or 2 years old. They recover. They seem to be doing just fine. And then when they're 8, they get an infection of their brain and die just overnight. It's called a panencephalitis, subsclerosing panencephalitis. And so it's the measles virus just coming back and taking over and killing that kid. And I can't imagine anything worse as a parent, right? And yet none of that stuff shows up in the discussions here of what these diseases look like before they were gone, right? So we don't have a treatment for measles, right? And you look at diphtheria. Diphtheria causes a gray exudate. It's called a coating on the back of your throat.
Oh, yeah.
And it builds up slowly, you know, over a week or two until you can't breathe and you die, right? I mean, these are just terrible ways to die.
Suffocate to death.
You suffocate to death.
Awful.
And, you know, it's effective. It's low cost. It's one of the very, you go back to 1900. Before we understood the germ theory of disease and how diseases were spread and stuff like that. And, you know, the average age of death was like 45 years old because so many kids died. You know, most civilizations have a celebration for a child when they reach 1 year old because they've made it through all those childhood illnesses.
Yeah.
And now, you know, the age of death is 80, in the 80s range, right? And so that, most of that is due to, quite frankly, immunizations. And not nearly as many babies dying, but those things don't seem to matter anymore. And
I want to ask you about two specific vaccines. First of all, the what do they call it? The shingles vaccine, which used to be chickenpox when you were little, and then it becomes shingles. Yeah. I have not gotten it. My wife did get it. They said the shot is actually rough. You get kind of sick for a day or two with the shot. Should every adult get the shingles vaccine? Yes or no? What do you think?
I think it's kind of up to you. Yeah, your arm will feel like it's going to fall off for a couple of days. It has a really robust immune response, and it activates your immune system. And so people complain. It feels like you got hit, you know, pretty hard in your arm. But
getting shingles, I heard, is
but shingles
pretty awful.
Can be nasty too, right? And so here's the data on shingles, and you can figure out whether you want to play that game. About 10% of the population will get shingles.
That's a lot. Yeah.
And generally it happens when something else is going on in your life, right? So something happens to lower your immunity. You get cancer, you have a really severe other infection, diabetes, something like that. And then that causes this reemergence. So what happens is the virus hides out in your nerve cells.
Right. I probably have them in there somewhere right now because I had chicken pox when I was little.
Then your immune system kind of pulls back, and that allows it to erupt out. And so they're literally erupting out of your nerve cells. So it's hard to imagine a better mechanism to inflict pain on somebody, right? Mm-hmm. And so it goes along the nerve root of that nerve that's been.
And that's where we feel nerves, right?
Yeah, that's coming out of your nerves. There are cases where it'll be in like your optic nerve, so it blinds you and come across your face and
permanently
like
or
that. Yeah.
Oh,
so
wow.
So but you know, I don't know where people feel about that 10% number, right? And,
yeah.
And then getting shingles twice is even rarer. It's about 10% of the 10%. So,
but that happens too.
That happens too. You know, if you're the unlucky one that gets shingles multiple times, that's really unfortunate. So.
Okay, I have a question about shingles.
Yeah.
Okay, so my older kids actually got the virus. It was before the vaccine for chickenpox came out. Then my younger kids got the vaccine, so they never actually got chickenpox. Are the younger kids that never had chickenpox susceptible to shingles as adults, or do you have to have had the virus to get shingles?
I think I think we're waiting to figure out the final proposition on that. But in theory, that being vaccinated for chickenpox should prevent you from having shingles later on in life. That's
nice.
Part of the logic behind the shingles vaccine, the chickenpox vaccine.
Okay. Well, and
we'll see. So, but sometimes, even though you don't get sick with chickenpox, it can still infect you, right? I mean, that's what you're doing with immunization is you're teaching your body how to fight it off before you get sick. But that's part of the whole COVID debate as well. You know, you shouldn't ever get COVID. That's not the point. The point is your body knows how to fight it off without the virus killing you first. And so the question is, well, can shingles then make it into your nerves even though you didn't really have chicken pox? So I think there's a little bit of an uncertainty there. I just wanted to issue a little bit of a disclaimer. So.
Okay. I got to ask you then about that one, the COVID vaccine. You know, I back in 2020, we were going on a cruise, maybe 21, and the cruise line wouldn't let us on the ship unless we had one. So I got a COVID vaccine. My wife and I both did. I have not gotten boosters or updates or any other COVID shots. Should I? Should I not? Would you? Will you? Would you not? And we're not going to take callers on this because we'll get a million opinions on this, but just real quick. And we have about a minute.
I'm in the camp that I believe if you got vaccinated originally and probably have had COVID at some point now, because
definitely
it's
did,
ubiquitously out there, you're going to be just fine.
Okay.
The one group where the data changes on that is in the over 85 crew, because they're just so fragile that I would get vaccinated every year if I was over 85. But
okay.
But for the rest of us, it's in that realm of endemic, they call it. It'll circulate every year, and it'll be part of the common cold routine, and we'll suffer with it a little bit, but it'll be okay, and we'll move on.
He's Dr. Blodgett. Mello's over there. Thanks, Mello, for helping today. Mm-hmm. We've run out of time. Myths busted today on the Andy Griffin Show. We'll see you later.